You are about to participate in the most ambitious culinary experiment ever imagined.
This competition is going to test everything.
Adapt quickly to anything. I mean anything. The wildest day of your life starts right now.
All new 24 and 24 Last Chef Standing. Sunday night at 8 on Food Network. Stream on Max.
Stew.
Stew.
De.
De.
Ew.
Ew. Studio.
That's it.
Right? Studio.
360 with Kurt Anderson.
Kurt Anderson.
Kurt Anderson.
I listen to it on the radio in my car.
So don't be sniffy about
I'm not being sniffy.
I think I you mean, are.
No, no.
You've got a nose for it.
Oh, gosh. Wow. What are you saying over there?
Today on the show,
your vision of reality is not necessarily what my vision of reality is.
I was just aesthetically enraptured.
Finally, it worked out. Keep listening. Stay right there. Don't go anywhere. Stay. Sit.
Sometimes I feel as though half the writers I know were once students of John McPhee.
The best piece of writing advice that John McPhee ever gave me was to be clear, and that it was better to be clear than to be clever. But if you could be clear and clever, that was best of all.
Good writing is rewriting. Good writing is good thinking. Good thinking is rethinking.
One of the things he would always say to me in the margins of my papers when I turned them in, if I'd gotten too kind of flamboyant and loosey-goosey, is he would write, sober up.
That's Joel Achenbach, who writes for The Washington Post. Before him, the author and artist Jenny Price, and Rick Stengel, the former editor of Time magazine and former undersecretary of state. John McPhee is particularly well known for his extremely long, rich, enlightening articles about nature, such as Encounters with the Archdruid and the Pine Barrens and Coming into the Country. He's been writing for a half century for The New Yorker magazine, more than 100 articles so far. Those pieces have transmuted into a couple of dozen books, and he won a Pulitzer Prize along the way. He's also been teaching students at Princeton since 1975 and has inspired and shaped generations of writers. Here is the author Jenny Price again.
He would bring in maybe his third or fourth draft of something that had been published and was wonderful and, you know, maybe won a Pulitzer Prize. And it was just black. Everything was crossed out and scribbles, you know. And then he would show you this succession of drafts until he finally got to a clean page, you know, many, many drafts later.
You have to understand how emotionally powerful this relationship is with me. I was a 19-year-old kid in his class. He was already a master of nonfiction.
You may recognize this voice as David Remnix, the editor of The New Yorker, and yet another McPhee student.
And if I could delight him with a sentence or a paragraph, nothing made me happier. One of the obsessions of the class and one of the obsessions of his book is structure. And as he broke it down and he described how he changes tense here and how it all worked, it gave you a sense of possibility. And the analogy I always use is as musicians, that it's true that a beginner can't play an advanced Beethoven sonata. It's just not going to happen. But here are the pieces, here are the elements that go into it. And if you only practice for 1,000 hours or 10,000 hours, you might actually get there. And that's what the course was pointing toward. And now here I am, and he's in his mid-80s, and I'm in my late 50s. I'm editing this magazine, and we have a relationship of pure friendship and as colleagues, but humming underneath it. So I know who the master is, and he certainly knows who the student is.
And now you can get some of John McPhee's tutelage as well without having to attend Princeton University. He has just published a book called Draft Number 4, On the Writing Process. And he is here to talk with me about it. John McPhee, a great pleasure finally to meet you and welcome you to Studio 360.
Hi, Kurt. Hello.
Hi. So, are you surprised now that you've had a couple of generations, 40 years for this to people to grow up and do what they do, are you surprised by who succeeds and who doesn't?
A little bit sometimes, but usually when they're that age, you just don't know. I mean, you know, David Remnick, people often ask me if I knew when David was very, very good, and I greatly enjoyed them as a student and everything else, but who knows? They're 20 years old. And
right.
So it's just pleased is the word, not surprised.
Right.
But really pleased. I mean, it's amazing what these people do.
So as a young person, when did you first think of yourself as a writer? That became your self-identity?
When I was about 8 years old or something like that. I used to be a sort of mascot for the Princeton football team. I grew up here. And I remember a very cold November day that was raining, and I'm on the sidelines of a football game, freezing in this rain and shivering. And I looked up at the press box, and I knew that they were in there with space heaters and a roof over their heads. And so I decided to be a writer.
As then you've proceeded to take yourself for weeks and months to Alaska and places like that. I'm not buying it that you wanted a space heater.
Right. No space heater with me.
And so you become a writer, a professional writer. You work at Time magazine. Then when was your first article accepted by The New Yorker?
1963. And that was 2 years before I became a staff writer there. That article was what they called a casual. And it was about the experience of playing basketball for Cambridge University. And it was just a small piece that didn't I was working at Time magazine, and this didn't make a big difference. But when I published a profile in The New Yorker of Bill Bradley 2 years later, that's when I joined the staff after that.
So the casual had also been about Bill Bradley playing in Cambridge?
No, it was about me playing.
Oh.
Me playing on the university basketball team over
there. I see. A different Princetonian playing on a different basketball team.
That's right. And it just was – that was the first piece in The New Yorker.
So you were in your 30s by that point.
Yes, I was. I wanted to write for The New Yorker from the time I was, you know, I started 16, 17, 18 years old thinking about it. And all through my 20s, I sent them pieces and they turned them all down. I could have papered the wall of my room with rejection slips. And I got one encouraging letter and so forth. But finally, it worked out when I was 31 and then 33 when I joined the staff.
I was in my early 40s before I got pieces published in The New Yorker. So that, I guess I'm 10 years less talented than you or something.
No, the longer you wait, the better it is.
Is that right? you say in this book that you are shy to the point of dread.
I can't tell you how many times I've pulled up, say, in a rented car to some place where somebody is that I'm going to be interviewing. And I'm just full of dread. And the thing is that in my work, I tend to spend a long time with people, and that does go away after a day or so.
Right. And because you take so long often to write pieces and spend so much time with people and take a long time writing them, maybe because you're not having to do a news story every 2 days like a newspaper reporter, your shyness is mitigated, right?
Yes, absolutely right. And, I mean, I'm full of awe about reporters who can go out, interview somebody, write the piece the same day. And, I mean, this is just beyond me, see?
Yeah. I would now love to hear you read a passage from the book.
Okay. The approach to structure in factual writing is like returning from a grocery store with materials you intend to cook for dinner. You set them out on the kitchen counter, and what's there is what you deal with and all you deal with. If something is red and globular, you don't call it a tomato if it's a bell pepper. To some extent, the structure of a composition dictates itself, and to some extent it does not. Where you have a free hand, you can make interesting choices.
So if nonfiction is like deciding how to make a meal from what's in your grocery bag, you've gone out and got the stuff. So fiction is what, like making a meal, but you forgot to shop for groceries, or you just have to sort of summon the ingredients?
Well, I don't know. But what I imagine is that the fiction writer is feeling her way. I have two daughters who are novelists.
Right.
And feeling her way and developing structure and stuff in a trial and error fashion moving along. And I'm sure that doesn't describe all fiction, but in nonfiction, you have collected your material first. So you got a different situation at the get-go.
Right. I think that's true. You tell a great story in the book about your teacher in high school who helped you understand structure in writing. Talk about Mrs. McKee and what her English class in the 1940s did for you.
a whole hell of a lot. Mrs. McKee, who was also the drama coach, just liked to have her kids writing. And not only that, I mean, three compositions a week. And we had to, if it was a poem, you turned it in with a structural outline. It could be anything. They were short. And she also had us, not everybody all at once, but read your piece aloud in class. And the other kids would boo and hiss. And it was a circus. And I just think that I really grew as a writer in there far more than I realized at the time.
So David Remnick was your student at Princeton, then became a terrific journalist at the Washington Post and then the New Yorker, and is now the editor of the New Yorker, where you're still a writer. So it seems as though you had a master plan to train him and then make him your boss or something.
He is my boss, and this is a bizarre relationship. But it's a wonderful, I mean, to go through this arc from William Shawn at the beginning and now
the long time editor of the New Yorker. Yeah.
Yeah. No, I feel really lucky because of the dialogue with him. It's really great.
Yeah. This book is a terrific combination of your memoir as a writer and this useful handbook on how to write, or at least how to write nonfiction, according to John McPhee. I kept circling and starring various points of your process and rules, if we can call them that, that I would like to go over with you and have you explain. First of all, you encourage writers to avoid blind leads. Explain what blind leads are and why they're bad and when they're occasionally okay.
Well, they're cheap. A blind lead is simply a piece that starts off with pronouns, he, she, whatever, but does not identify who you're talking about.
Right.
And then, you know, in sentence number 7 or 10 or something like that, you reveal, as if you're pulling a rabbit out of a hat,
yes,
who this person is. Well, that's a pretty tawdry thing to do.
Yes.
But at the same time, it's fun.
Yes.
I did that with Sophia Loren. This was a Time cover story. And I think that may be the only blind lead I ever did in a long piece. But I tell them, you know, blind leads range from cheap to very cheap.
Yes.
So ration yourself.
Yes.
That's
no, I totally agree. And I was particularly interested in this because in this book I just wrote, one of my chapters has a very, very long blind lead. And I thought, wow, am I cheap? Am I tawdry? And then I decided, no, it was justified in this particular case.
Absolutely. Nobody should ever tell you not to do that. Just
right.
Don't do it every time out.
Yes, exactly. You argue that only the writer should write his or her title or headline. And I guess you get to do that, but that is not standard in American journalism. Is this really a hill that you encourage young writers to die on?
I think that the title is an integral part of the piece of writing.
Uh-huh.
And therefore, it should be written by the person whose name is the byline.
Right. You talk about the tension that always exists in structuring an article between the chronology of then this happened, then this happened, then this happened, and the themes. But those are the basic two ways you can organize a nonfiction piece. But explain, again, with an example, if you would, what that tension is and how that works.
I used to teach students that you couldn't write a journey without using a chronological structure. And then I went across the United States with a truck driver, and there was no good way to write that chronologically. It was just, it would be so boring and so expectable. And there are all kinds of themes in the trucking world, truck stops and fuel economy and keep going. And so I threw up my hands and said, okay, I'm going to do a thematic structure and let the reader worry about the chronology. The notion of where we went was established at the beginning, so any reader would know that all this had happened on this long trip.
Right. It was very interesting for me. I'd never thought of writing nonfiction in such a simple way, that this tension between chronology and theme, but that's it. And it was one of the many useful illuminations I received from reading this book. So thank you.
You're welcome. After listening to you for all these years, it just amazes me that something's going the other way.
Well, you know, that's the beauty of our respective jobs. Would you read one more excerpt before we go?
Sure thing. In the late 1960s, I was working in rented space on Nassau Street up a flight of stairs over Nathan Casserell, optometrist. Across the street was the main library of Princeton University. Across the hall was the Swedish Massage, operated by an Austrian couple who were nearing retirement and had been there for decades. It was a legitimate business. They massaged everything from college football players to arthritic ancients, and they didn't give sex. This, however, was the era when massage became a sexual synonym, and most evenings, avoiding writing, looking down from my window on the passing scene, I would see men in business suits stop, hesitate, look around, and then move toward the glass door at the foot of the stairs. Eventually, the Austrians had to scrape the words Swedish massage off the door and replace them with a hanging sign they removed when they went home. Meanwhile, the men kept arriving at the top of the stairs where neither door was marked. When they knocked on mine and I opened it, their faces fell dramatically as the busty Swede they expected turned into a short and bearded man. In this context, I wrote three related pieces that became a book called Encounters with the Archdruid.
You grew up in Princeton, New Jersey. You teach at Princeton University. You still live in Princeton, New Jersey. Is that because Princeton is the greatest place on earth, or you just stumbled into that and it's a nice place to be while you're traveling around the world doing these long journalistic expeditions?
Well, first of all, the publisher is in New York, right? And I lived in New York for 5 years. In the first 5 years, I was at Time Magazine, and when we were looking around for a place to go, and went to Princeton, it was because of the university library here, because of imagining that if I could ever do the work I hoped to do, that library would be a great tool. That was the thing that made Princeton, the marginal thing that made Princeton more appealing than other suburbs or whatever when we made this move.
Right.
So, you know, I've lived in Princeton all my life with the exception of those years in the city.
But given that your work takes you all over the place, or has taken you all over the place all the time, having that extremely familiar little place must be comforting, reassuring.
Right on the nose. And I've always looked upon it as a kind of fixed foot, you know, in a compass, and you go around. My daughters think I'm provincial and funny.
That's what daughters are there for.
That's right. You got that one right.
John McPhee, thank you so much. This has been my complete pleasure.
It's been a complete pleasure for me too, Kurt.
John McPhee has been a writer for The New Yorker for 54 of its 92 years of existence, and he's a professor of writing at Princeton University. His new book, Draft Number 4, On the Writing Process, is out now. Coming up, critics hate the new Netflix reboot of the sitcom Full House. It's called Fuller House. But BJ Novak disagrees.
It fits in to the original narrative in a way that is just like the shot of sitcom dopamine that everyone wanted from Full House.
The great comedy writer and actor sticks up for a sitcom that gets no respect. That's next in Studio 360 from Public Radio International in association with Slate. BJ Novak is best known for writing and acting in one of the great influential comedies of the last 20 years, The Office. Since then, he's been a big deal best-selling author and actor in feature films. But there's a TV show that critics and lots of smart viewers loathe that is one of his favorites. It's a show that a reviewer at the AV Club called a porn parody without the porn. As part of our Studio 360 Guilty Pleasures series, BJ Novak defends this show in its current Netflix reboot and the original series, which premiered when he was a little kid.
I was 9, 10, 11 years old in Newton, Massachusetts, which to me was defined by its winters and gray weather. And to see this Californian utopia which I didn't even really know about this place. It looked so different. It was so bright. That soaring helicopter shot on a crystal clear day over the Golden Gate Bridge, over the sparkling Blue Bay. This was my introduction to the idea of California. My name is BJ Novak. I'm an actor and writer, and the guilty pleasure I'm here to defend is Fuller House. Fuller House is the Netflix reboot of the much maligned 90s sitcom Full House, starring Bob Saget,
wake up San Francisco,
Dave Coulier,
cut it out,
and John Stamos,
have mercy,
as three adult men raising three young daughters, played by Candace Cameron,
oh my Lanta,
Jodie Sweetin,
well pin a rose on your nose,
and the Olsen twins.
You got it, dude.
I should explain, I fell in love with sitcoms before knowing that they were supposed to be funnier comedies, and I even wrote a letter to my local TV stations in Boston telling them that they should have more sitcoms on without even knowing that com meant comedy. I just thought these were pleasant shows. I just liked seeing another family, how they worked, I guess.
Hey, hey.
Let me take a wild guess. You stopped at the mall after school, huh?
We had to buy gifts for Kathy's shower tonight.
I didn't need Full House to be a comedy. I just thought it was a great show.
Your friend Kathy Santoni is getting married?
She's already married. She's having a baby.
What? You can't believe that little kid is having a little kid.
One of the things that makes a great sitcom is the comforting, reliable aesthetics of sight and sound. We like bright, happy settings, flooded with light and possibility, and we like the rhythms of certain sounds, both dialogue rhythms and laughter rhythms.
Well, I'm not so sure that you should be allowed in a boy's apartment without some kind of supervision, like an armed guard.
Oh, don't worry, T-Bone. I'll be there.
That's a comfort.
The actors were excellent with timing, and the sound mixing was excellent. It just sounded right.
Come on, Dad. It's just a place to hang out. I'll be home at 11, I promise.
Okay. You can go, but I want you back at 11 on the dot, okay?
Okay.
So that's why I think I was hypnotized by the show as a kid. I don't think I laughed at it, but I didn't groan either. I was just aesthetically enraptured. So that's the original Full House. The reboot. Is the most you could call it shameless, or you could call it symmetrical reboot that has ever been accomplished. Now it's called Fuller House. DJ, played by Candace Cameron, is now the mom.
Good morning.
And she is raising these boys. She is also, sadly, a widow, just as her father was a widower.
My husband died doing what he loved, fighting fires and helping people. He'd want me to be strong.
So now she needs to turn to help to two women, her sister, played by Jodie Sweetin.
You guys did your share for us. Now it's time for me to step up.
And Kimmy Gibbler, her neighbor from growing up.
So I'm moving in too.
Now these three women have to raise these boys in the exact same house. It's the exact same show, and yet it fits in to the original narrative in a way that is just like the shot of sitcom dopamine that everyone wanted from Full House. It's kind of stunning in its audacity.
Please welcome to the show, John Stamos.
When Fuller House debuted, it did not seem to receive much respect, to say the least.
The Washington Post said there's a point
give
where...
Give the guy's name, by the way. You're missing the names.
All right, Hank Stuver.
Okay.
There's a point where nostalgia becomes more like necrophilia, and Fuller House immediately crosses that line. New York Times, the series begins as a sitcom family reunion.
Mm-hmm.
It becomes a self-conscious, dated, and maudlin reminder of the ceaseless march of time and your inevitable demise.
I think reboot should continue the joy of the original. And for many projects, repeating it would not continue the joy, because what we loved about the original was an unpredictability and a shock. But the opening theme song to Full House begins with the line, "Whatever happened to predictability?" Whatever happened to predictability? So you could say that this was fated, inevitable, that they would come out with a second version of this that was so gloriously embracing the idea of predictability. In fact, the whole lyric is, "Whatever happened to predictability? Whatever happened to predictability? The milkman, the paperboy, evening TV." It is nostalgic for a time when TV was predictable. This is its mission statement of the show. I'm not going to convince anyone that if you don't think you'll like Fuller House, you should watch it. That's not the case. If you do feel inclined to watch Fuller House, I'm saying I get it, and I'm there too. And I didn't realize I cared so much until I watched it, and I was just right back into that wide-eyed kid mode, just like gazing at this Golden California world.
That story was produced by Studio 360's Tommy Bazarian. Have you got a guilty pleasure? Something you might not even admit to friends, but that you'd be willing to talk about on a national radio program? If so, send a voice memo or an email to guiltypleasures@studio360.org. Frederick Sacker is a Swedish painter who makes these really exceptionally photorealistic pictures. A few years ago, he devised the ultimate test for whether or not his portraits had crossed the uncanny valley.
When I paint, I work almost like a copy machine or a Xerox machine. I only look at color and I look at shapes. I almost always paint from a photograph. I know exactly what to do, and I know exactly where I'm finished. I don't really get the artist that sits around and smoking cigarettes, drinking coffee, and waiting for inspiration to strike. For me, it's very mechanical. I just sit down and work. Painting faces are a bit more difficult than painting like roses or your average still lifes. Although painting realism isn't that hard. I often preach that it's more a technique and everyone could learn to do it. But you need time and you need to be willing to put the effort into it. When people see my paintings, they always say that they look like photographs. And that got me thinking. Could I actually make a photograph out of a painting? My driver's license started to get real shabby and I needed to renew it. So I set up a small photo studio, took a self-portrait, and from that I painted an oil painting. Took a little photograph of that and sent it to Transportstyrelsen, AAA in Sweden, I don't know what it's called. They couldn't see it was a painting.
There is a guy, there's a Swedish artist. I just love this guy. He's called Frederick Sacker, and he painted the picture for his driving license. So wow. He did a self-portrait, he took a photo of the self-portrait, and he submitted it, and the authorities said, fine.
It was not likely I wanted to fool them. It was more like to test myself. For me, I believe my painted portrait is more a resemblance of me than a photograph. The painting itself is titled This Is Not Me, which is a reference to Magritte's This Is Not a Pipe. That painting is a painting of a pipe with the text This Is Not a Pipe. I think he nails it right there, and I believe my work is a continuing painting of that one. In my family, there is a history of brain-related diseases. It's all from Alzheimer's. My father died of an aneurysm when I was about 10. So I know that your vision of reality is not necessarily what my vision of reality is. and it could change in a heartbeat. Most people don't look like themselves in the photographs they use on the driver's license. I never met someone that said, oh, I look so good and this is really me on my driver's license. So it's more me than an actual photo because it's part of me. I try to look extra bad on my photographs. So my face is blemished and my hair is really bad and I didn't shave for 2 weeks. So my beard is really bushy. Looking back at it, I might have wanted to look a bit better because I got all the recognition of it and the photo got all through the world and I was on TV with it. So it would have been nice to look better on the photo. It would have been.
By the way, the Swedish Transport Agency allowed Fredrik to keep his hand-painted driver's license even after they found out about the scheme. I love Sweden. You can see the image for yourself at pri.org/studio360. That story was produced by Thomas Henley with sound design by Tommy Bazarian. Coming up, terrific pop music from Mali in West Africa. Amadou and Mariam will be right here to perform live in Studio 360 from Public Radio International in association with Slate.
Studio 360.
Amadou Bagayoko and Mariam Doumbia met 40-odd years ago when they were students at Mali's Institute for the Young Blind. They started performing together in the school orchestra, got married, and since then have made records and performed as a duo all over the world. Toured with U2, worked with Damon Albarn of Blur and the Gorillaz, released 8 studio albums so far, and been nominated for a Grammy. Their new album is called Confusion, and Amadou and Mariam are here in Studio 360 with their interpreter, David Serrero.
Thank you so much.
Welcome.
Merci.
One of your first big hits, I think maybe your first really big hit outside of Africa was in 1999, the song Je Pense à Toi, I Think of You. I want to play a little bit of that for our listeners. Je pense à toi, mon amour, ma bien-aimée. Ne m'abandonne pas, mon amour, ma chérie. That's Je Pense à Toi by Amadou and Mariam back in the late 1990s. I love that song, and I wish we could play the whole thing because it's a great example of your signature style of Malian blues. Is that an actual term, Malian blues?
Oui, ça peut être correct parce que
le blues has not really any boundaries. So
nous l'avons aussi au Mali.
They have, in a way, blues in Mali also.
And because African Americans came from Africa and therefore the blues are African?
Oui, on a toujours dit ça, oui.
We always say that, yeah, that's true.
But is there actually a kind of blues tradition, a modern 20th century blues tradition in Mali?
Maintenant, ils commencent à en avoir.
Now they start to have a more modern way of doing blues because the musicians are traveling more all over the world.
Ils commencent à avoir une autre forme plus moderne du blues.
So they bring with them all their influence and there is all this mix of different colors.
Gotcha. And the new album, Confusion, has a very different sound. And I want to now introduce our listeners to a song from that, if we may.
Oh, d'accord, ça nous fait plaisir de jouer Bofusa.
On va jouer. Our pleasure to play this song for you.
Excellent.
Bofusafu ye tien colon.
bofu safu ankana ke bofu safu ye di akono bofu safu kana ke bofu safu ye
deli
ni wolola ni mabrake bofu safu ye ni alala ni toma fo bofu safu ni mafenye ifani bae bofu safu Nima fenye ibali mauye bofu safu Nima fenye iworole uye bofu safu Nima fenye zinyo uye bofu safu Bofu safu, nima ke bofu safu uye Bofu safu, kanake bofu safu uye enteri Nima fenye ifafla unye bofu safu Nima fenye ibafla unye bofu safu Nima fenye jamana kono bofu safu Ikawari mata ala kola bofu safu Ikawari mata ala kola bofu safu Bofu safu, nima ke bofu safu ye Il faut travailler dans la vie Il faut pas croiser les bras dans la vie Il faut se rendre utile dans la vie Bofu safu ya manyinde Bofu safu, ni make bofu safu ye Bofu safu, ni make bofu safu ye abala Akana ke bofu safu ye diakono E bofu safu Akana ke bofu safu ye diakono
Yeah. Thank you.
Thank you. That was Amadou and Mariam playing Bofu Safu. Can you, before we go on and talk some more, introduce the other two members of your band?
Oui, Charlie, qui joue sur les claviers.
There is Charlie on the keyboards.
Et il y a Joël qui fait les percussions.
There is Joël on the percussions.
Mm-hmm.
Excellent. So that song, Bofu Safu, from their new album, Confusion, what a great song. And as I this the fourth or fifth time I've listened to it, and every time I've heard it, in my head, I'm imagining the beginning of a movie. It just seems like that should start a movie.
Ah, effectivement, bon? Parce que l'introduction, il peut faire début de film, film surtout.
The down, intro down, can down, definitely down. Be the beginning of a movie.
Exactly. No, on the recorded version, I thought, oh, it's like in a James Bond movie.
Wow. On écoutait aussi James Brown beaucoup.
We're listening also a lot of James Brown.
Yeah. Excellent. So in figuring out how we were going to talk to you and what we were going to talk to you about and learning more about you, we asked both of you to talk about some of your influences musically. Amadou, you gave us this list of guitarists, very diverse list of guitarists. John Lee Hooker. And, of course, Jimi Hendrix. B.B. King, whom I saw live at age 16. Jimmy Page, of course, Led Zeppelin. And David Gilmour from Pink Floyd. Three Americans, two Brits, all of them got big and broke out in the 1960s, and such different types of guitarists.
Oui, parce que, en fait, ça m'a beaucoup influencé parce que nous, nous jouons de la musique.
So we play a lot of a music that we call Bambara.
Anglo,
who has a lot in common with this American Britannic music.
And Bambara is a style or is an individual?
No, c'est une langue parlée au Mali.
Oh, it's a language that is spoken in Mali.
La langage aussi et ethnie aussi.
Also an ethnicity also as well.
Got you. So what about the blues man, John Lee Hooker. What, was there a particular guitar lick he did that influenced you?
Oui, bon, quand il jouait, bon, ça,
when he was playing, it sounded a lot like a music Bambara.
Donc, ça nous faisait un grand
it was a great pleasure to listen to him, and we were also very surprised.
So could you illustrate that? Like, what did Hooker do, and what is a Bambara sound?
Oui, d'accord.
I know that.
John Lecoeur, mais avec le Bambara.
With the Bambara style.
Get that.
C'est ça, oui.
And I want to say that on the John Lee Hooker bit, you were accompanied on finger snapping by Mariam.
Oui, merci.
Mariam, you've said that you were influenced musically by the French singer Sheila. I want to play a bit of her biggest hit from 1979 called Spacer.
He's a ladies' man, always quick with a kiss on the hand, protects the soul at the rate it answer a call. In his own special way, he is gentle and kind. Oppression he hates, love in his eyes. My heart keeps a beat when I'm by his side.
So, what do you like about that song, Mariam?
Sa voix surtout.
Her voice especially.
Sa voix me plaisait beaucoup. J'ai imité Sheila à l'époque quand j'étais petite.
When I was a child, I was listening and I was trying to imitate, impersonate the voice of Sheila.
Mon surnom était Sheila. Tout le monde m'appelait Sheila.
Everybody used to call me Sheila. My nickname was Sheila.
Uh-huh. Même jusqu'à présent, il y a des copines qui m'appellent Sheila.
Even to this day, I have some girlfriends who are calling me Sheila.
Right. And Sheila was married to her partner, Ringo. Not the Ringo of the Beatles, but a French Ringo.
Si.
So Amadou is your Ringo at the time?
Bon, il peut être Ringo s'il est d'accord.
He may also be Ringo if he agrees.
I would love to hear another song by you two. What will you sing and play for us now?
Je pense que normalement on doit jouer Dimanche à Bamako.
So we'd love to play for you a song that is called Dimanche à Bamako, which is Sunday in Bamako.
Sunday in Bamako, where I assume, which is the capital of Mali, and where you live when you're in Mali?
Oui, c'est là-bas on vit.
Yes, that's
et puis
where we live.
C'est surtout les jours de mariage.
And this is especially Sunday in Bamako is the day of the weddings.
Mm-hmm.
Let's listen.
Show, 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 show.
Les dimanches à Bamako, c'est les jours de mariage. Les dimanches à Bamako, c'est les jours de mariage. Les dimanches à Bamako, c'est les jours de mariage. Les djembés et les dounous résonnent partout. Les balas et les tamas résonnent partout. La kora et le goni sont aussi au rendez-vous. Les dimanches à Bamako, c'est les jours de mariage. Les dimanches à Bamako, c'est les jours de mariage. Les parents et les sympathisants sont au rendez-vous. Les copains et les voisins sont au rendez-vous. Les founets et les djellis sont aussi au rendez-vous. Les dimanches à Bamako, c'est les jours de mariage. Les dimanches à Bamako, c'est les jours de mariage. Les hommes et les femmes ont mis les beaux boubous, les bijoux et les chaussures sont au rendez-vous. Les bassins et les bogolins sont au rendez-vous. La mariée et le marié sont aussi au rendez-vous. Les dimanches à Bamako, c'est les jours de mariage. Les sotarama, les douni, les taxis et les voitures, les frères, les sœurs, les badauds et les griots. Les dimanches à Bamako, c'est le jour de mariage. 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 Les dimanches à Bamako. Les dimanches à Bamako. Les dimanches à Bamako. Les dimanches à Bamako, c'est les jours de mariage. C'est les jours de mariage. Olé! C'est les jours de mariage.
Yeah!
That is Amadou and Mariam playing Dimanche à Bamako, Sunday in Bamako, off their album of 2005. That album you made along with, you collaborated with the French, Spanish, whatever else artist, speaking of No Frontiers, and producer Manu Chao. What was that experience like?
Ce travail, c'était... Déjà, on aimait sa chanson, sa voix.
We loved donc, his music and his voice.
Pour travailler ensemble, c'est lui qui a mis dans les journaux qu'il aime travailler avec nous.
Manu Chao mentioned the idea that he would love to work with us.
On a fait les chansons là-bas et puis quand on est venu ici.
And then after he went to Mali and this is where we did the songs.
Uh-huh. These, for the last 20 years, all kinds of musicians from Europe and the United States have wanted to work with you. Are you open to collaborations or are you careful about who you choose?
Nous, déjà, on aime le mélange. On est ouvert à travailler avec tout le monde.
We are open to work with everybody because we love to mix things.
I hear it. Well, it's been a complete pleasure meeting you both and seeing you both and having you both play here. And before we let you out of here, we'd love you to play one more song. And this will be which?
Fila ou Besame.
Fila ou Besame, oui.
And what's this song about?
C'est hommage au peuple. Il y a le peuple partout. Au Mali, au Burkina.
It's about an ethnicity that is called the Peul. And the Peul, we can hear them, we can see them in several countries in Africa.
All over West Africa.
All over West Africa.
Excellent. Let's hear it.
On y va?
Allez-y.
Show, 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 show.
Jamayo nebe fila u barakada, fila u bimbalo, fila u bisame. Ah, jamayo nebe fila u barakada, fila u bimbalo, fila u bisame.
Fila kangelendigu yon nebe fila u barakada,
fila u bimbalo, fila u bisame.
Fila lalibotikiu yon nebe fila u barakada,
fila u bimbalo, fila u bisame.
Fila sonumatikiu yon nebe fila u barakada,
fila u bimbalo, fila u bisame.
Fila mobilinumatikiu yon nebe fila u barakada,
fila u bimbalo.
Fila nonokenetikiu yon nebe fila u barakada,
fila u bimbalo.
Fila sakaweratikiu yon nebe fila u fo,
fila u bimbalo.
Fila misiweratikiu yon nebe fila u fo,
fila u bimbalo.
Ah, jamayo nebe fila u barakada, fila u bimbalo, u bisame.
That's Amadou and Mariam playing Filao Besame.
Their new album, Confusion, will be out on September 22nd. And that's it for this week's episode of Studio 360. Studio 360 is a production of PRI, Public Radio International, in association with Slate. Our executive producer is
Jocelyn Gonzalez.
Our senior editor is
Andrew Adam Newman.
Our technical director is
Louis Mitchell.
Our producers are
Sam Kim,
Skylar Swenson,
Zoe Saunders,
Tommy Bazarian.
And our production assistant is
Claude Glett.
And I'm Kurt Anderson. Thank you so much for listening. Thank you.
Thank
that
you.
Was great.
Thank you very
much. Really
thank you very much.
C'est vraiment un grand plaisir.
PRI, Public Radio International.
Next time on Studio 360, when colorful cartoons are off color.
You always hear about mass shootings affecting other people's movie openings, but you never think they're going to affect your movie opening.
If it's humans doing it, live action, you kind of don't like those people, but when it's like a cute pink cat, it feels a little lighter.
Kurt Anderson talks with BoJack Horseman creator Raphael Bob Waksberg. That's next time in Studio 360.